Call the Tax Conference Committee to order. Good morning, Saturday morning. The Senate had, I think we posted a number of issues that we have information and issues in our bill around that the House does not. Some of these you have, we have joint thing, articles, but I'd like to spend the day more informational than anything else, walking through some of these issues, seeing if we can get them fleshed out a little bit, and maybe when we start to move issues, these will be a little quicker then. And so if we could start, Madam Chair, with the TILT, and there was a working group that met through the summer on the payment in lieu, and you know the payment in lieu is in place of property tax for the public land that's across the state. And Ms. Damon here? And if I could ask Ms. Damon just to walk through a little bit what the group did and what they, what recommendations they had. We've included a number of their recommendations in our bill, and we also have some other areas that we brought forward also that we'll talk about today. So if we could start with Ms. Damon.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Susan Damon. I'm from the Department of Natural Resources, and I was the project manager for the PILT report. There was a report that was required by the 2011 legislature and required the Commissioner of Natural Resources, Commissioner of Management and Budget, Commissioner of Revenue to cooperate with stakeholders in examining and making recommendations on a number of issues related to PILT. And those included the purpose of the payment system and criteria for payments, the rate of payments for specific classes of natural resources lands, the adequacy of current funding for payments, and the impact of additional land acquisition on the funding, alternative methods for reimbursing local units of government for state natural resources lands, and the formula for distribution of payments to local units of government. The PILT report was finalized in December of 2012, and many of the recommendations that were made by the advisory group that worked on this issue are contained in this legislation. Would you like me to walk through the bill and explain what comes from the PILT report? And
yes, Ms. Damon, if you would mention the areas that we are removing from the bill, the, like the goose management area and then the additions, and then if you could, well, I'll talk about the rates because we're going from three flat rates to two.
Okay. One of the recommendations of the working group was that the PILT payment system be simplified. It is extremely complex. It is currently found in, parts are found in Chapter 97A, 97A061. The remaining parts of PILT are found in the Local Government Aid Chapter 477A. And so there was a recommendation, and also there are nine different categories of payments currently in the system. The advisory group recommended that some of the minor payment categories be eliminated. One is a special payment rate for goose management croplands. These are lands that are around the or in the Lockwood Pearl Wildlife Management Area. This was a special PILT law that dates back to the 60s, and it's no longer needed because at that time there was not a value-based payment, and so this was special legislation. But since 1995, acquired lands are paid based on 0.75% of the appraised value. So there was a recommendation to eliminate that special payment and just roll those payments into the regular acquired lands payment rate. There was also a recommendation to eliminate a minor payment category. It's a second payment that's made for hunting lands. It's been a very small payment over the past few years. It is an additional payment that is made after the payment for those same lands is calculated under Chapter 477A. And then there was a recommendation to repeal and move the remaining provisions of Section 97A into the LGA PILT law in Chapter 477A.
And Madam Chair, this is on page 13 and 14, Article 1, Section 17 of the Senate bill. And Ms. Damon, did you want to talk to us a little bit about the transportation wetland, the wildlife management lands, and the military game refuge?
Yes, transportation wetland, that was just a redefinition. That is already in the law, and there's no substantive change regarding that. The wildlife management land is just a renaming of what is now called hunting lands and game refuges, which is in Chapter 97A061. It does not change the law substantively. It just renames it to make it reflect more accurately what those lands are called today. The hunting grounds, game refuges terminology came from the 30s, and the payments are currently made on acquired lands that are in wildlife management areas. So it's a little bit clearer, less confusing language. Military game refuge, that there is a special payment for Camp Ripley Game Refuge, and this doesn't change the law substantively. It just creates a definition that applies.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, can you just help me direct me again to where this is in the Senate bill, and specifically you'd reference going from three levels to two and where the repealer is, I think, on the hunting, the extra hunting lands? Am I following this correctly?
It's Article 1. It's page 13 through 16, I think.
Page 12 on the side-by-side.
And Ms. Damon, if you could talk briefly about the two different mechanisms for making these payments, the flat rate versus the three-quarters of 1% of appraised value.
So I assume these are the three categories, right?
Mr. Chair, members, there is the ability for a county to receive a payment on acquired lands, which are lands that are acquired by the DNR from private ownership. County gets a payment on those lands that is a value-based payment, 3/4 of 1% of the appraised value. But many other types of land that are not acquired from private ownership, such as school trust lands, tax-forfeited lands that are administered by the county, lands that the DNR acquired directly from the federal government, are paid at flat rates instead of a value-based rate. And the language in the bill maintains some payments at flat rate. It doesn't change any of the flat rate payments to the value-based payment.
So, Madam Chair, what's going on is some of the PILT are based on value, so they adjust over time as the values change. And of course, the flat rate would only change if the legislature changes the flat rate. So that's part of the initiative that we did, is we took the three flat rates that they were, combined it into two, took the state-administered and the county-administered lands and made them the same. They were at different rates before. We didn't see that there was a much differential between those, and then adjusted the flat rates upward to take into account some of the changes over time that have occurred. And the other thing that I think we should talk a little bit about, and I don't know if Mr. Myers or Ms. Damon has this with them, but the area that is the fastest growing in the PILT area is this acquired land that's done on value. Do you have any of that information, Ms. Meyer or Ms. Damon?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't have that information with me.
Madam Chair, we can get that for the committee, but my recollection is that when you look at the payment in lieu program as a whole, the area, and there is some concerns over the growth that's occurred in this, I understand that, but the area that where the growth is occurring is in the acquired lands area. And part of it's because of the mechanism that's used. Part of that's because of the mechanism that's used for calculating the PILT payment that's based on value.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department
Mr.
of Natural Resources. Those payments have gone up drastically because of the valuation of land they are based on. They are reassessed every 5 years. So just for practical purposes, about 6 years ago, the payments to NLU total were about $14 million. Now they're a little bit north of $25 million due to the revaluation of land. We'll see some of that come down a little bit since, you know, the land prices were skyrocketing and now they've leveled off and are going down in certain areas. But some of these recommendations were, as we talked about, from the PILT task force. We do support those. The fiscal side of it, the group talked about doing those changes, but obviously the administration didn't support, because they weren't in the governor's budget recommendations, some of the changes. But recognizing that the inflation was taken away last biennium and the impacts that that had and the impacts of these counties, it was something the group discussed. There are a couple other changes that we've talked to staff about that we'd like to see done, just removing some duplicative language and clarifying the statutes, moving them all into 477.
And Mr. Myers, Ms. Damon, did the group recommend that the inflation adjuster be reinstated?
Mr. Chair, members, there was a recommendation that the legislature consider reinstating the inflation adjustment for flat rates.
And we're not proposing that. Madam Chair, we do have a run. I thought that
it's being copied
right now. I think we handed it to you yesterday.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest
and Senator Representative Dan asked about the there's a trying to find a repealer, and we someone caught that yesterday, and we will have an if we adopt these provisions, we would have an amendment. Take into account the repealer and the technical reference to that so that it works.
And Madam Chair, I do have a technical amendment for this provision. When we finally move on it, I don't know if you want to adopt a technical amendment now so the language is out. And then, do you have the PILT amendment to hand out, the technical PILT amendment?
Yep. That's what I was just referring to.
Sure.
It's a repealer.
Representative Van Zel, anything you want to add to the PILT discussion?
Thank you. I think it would be useful if we had just kind of a quick overview of the spreadsheet.
And I think this is prepared by Ms. Damon. Is this yours?
Ms.
Damon?
Yeah, that's the spreadsheet. Is that the spreadsheet? Okay.
Oh, sure. Representative Luncheski moves the A46 amendment, technical PILT amendment. Any questions, members?
You can have this.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A46 adopted. Thank you. Ms. Damon.
Okay. The spreadsheet that you have before you shows the these are the calculations of the 2013 payments that were done in early March are for different types of land. There's a acquired land total payment, and then the columns that are not highlighted show the calculations for this year's payment without any changes to existing law. And then the highlighted columns you have shows the proposed rate increases for LUP, shows what that would be compared to the payment under current rate. There's also a column, the DNR administered payment shows what those changes by county would be in the payment if the new rates are adopted. And then also there's a change in rates for the county-administered payment. These are tax-forfeited lands other than platted lots within a city. And the highlighted column shows a comparison between what those rates would be under the change and what the current rates are. And then there's also a column that shows what the increase by county would be, the total gross Senate payment rates and the total increase by county.
And Ms. Damon, just because we haven't talked about it, the LUP lands, those are federal lands. Could you help us understand that?
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. Those are federal lands that are leased by the DNR and administered, managed for wildlife.
Thank you. Any questions, members?
Good. Helpful.
Well, Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, is the number on the bottom of the spreadsheet, of this spreadsheet, linked to a number on the overall spreadsheet? Where does the 475 old come from?
Senator Rest, we are carrying this on the spreadsheet, but I don't have mine.
Should that be, is that this number?
Mr. Chair.
The number on this.
Ms. McQuaid? Ms. McQuaid, why is the number on line 90, our spreadsheet for payment in lieu, different than the number on the DNR's spreadsheet? We're carrying $300,000 more. Oh, I know why that is. There's some language in here for a $300 payment for, it's actually for ditch assessments that the DNR recognizes that they owe. There's language in on page.
So it's a different number.
It's an addition to the payment in lieu. It is on page 15, line 20, without regard to acreage, $300,000 for local assessments under Section 84A55, Subdivision 9. That's a number that the DNR.
Okay, so it's so, Mr. Chairman, it's just not separately stated on the overall overall spreadsheet. So it's this number here plus that $300,000.
Yes, and we're carrying that in the Pilt area as a payment.
And Mr. Chairman, can you tell me what section that is?
Article 1, Section 21. It's on page 15, line 20.
It's in Section 21?
In Section 21.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Meyer?
If this provision is adopted, we should make sure that we're using the most accurate acres that are out there. There may be a discrepancy in some of the acreages that were used and the acreages that we're presenting in this spreadsheet. So we can provide you with the most up-to-date acreages and what that fiscal impact will be.
Yeah. Mr. Myers, we're not planning on moving this today. But
I understand that, but just we'll provide that to staff.
Okay. Anything else, members? Representative Benson.
Thank you. Just a clarification, Mr. Chair. I think probably you did tell us, but the differential between the present payments and these proposed ones is mostly because of the acquired lands increases. Is that the primary reason? If there are others as well?
Sure. Well, Representative Benson, what's happening in the acquired land care category? Because counties can choose whether they do the flat rate or a value mechanism. Okay. Most of them are choosing the value mechanism because their payment is higher. And so that's driving that acquired lands category. The flat rate hasn't been adjusted for a number of years, and I'm just proposing that we adjust it upwards to take into inflation into account.
Without
doing it.
Without putting an inflator on there. The recommendation of the working group was to add an automatic inflation adjuster to the program. It used to be in there. It was removed 2010?
11.
Mr. Chairman.
When was the inflation adjuster removed?
Yes, last biennium.
Last biennium.
2011.
And rather than, you know, to be honest with you, if you look through the Senate bill, there are very few inflation adjusters. We removed it from LGA. We think it's good to go back and look at these things legislatively. So we didn't put the inflator in, but we recognize that inflation occurs, and so we adjusted the rates upward. We did look at the, as I mentioned earlier, the state-administered and the county-administered lands. We didn't understand the differential there, so we put them both under the same flat rate and then adjusted it upwards.
Just to follow up, if we could.
Sir, Representative Benson.
Let's assume that for whatever reason these land values begin to flatten out or even decline. What effect would that have on these lands?
On the land that's the payment that's being determined by value, it could go the other way.
It could.
It could go the other way. On the flat rate, it would stay the flat rate unless the legislature readjusted it.
Then I suppose the municipalities, the counties, then will go back to the flat rate.
Well, I think that the differential has gotten to be quite a bit more on the value mechanism. I don't think we would see that, but perhaps.
Yeah. Okay.
The other question I have, members, there is a purpose statement in here, and I know generally we don't include those, so we probably will want to take that out before we adopt it. Well, Senator Rest.
Although the House, in responding to some provision somewhere, has purpose statements for the new tax expenditures. Didn't I see that somewhere in your bill? No, I know that, but I saw it. The new expenditures having to be explained. Is that correct, or did I not read that correctly?
Representative Lencheski.
That's current law. That was passed in 2010.
Oh, I know that, but.
Senator Ness.
For every new tax expenditure, there needs to be a purpose statement in the law. That's the current law, correct?
Yes.
So where there are new tax expenditures, there are purpose. There need to be a purpose statement.
Sure.
So
okay. Maybe we'll leave it in.
You may want to leave it in, Senator Skoy.
Or Madam Chair?
You may want to repeal the whole thing.
That the House carried that provision in 2009 or 10 and prevailed in conference. And the idea there is to get the legislature to look at tax expenditures. And so I ended up being the chief author, sort of accidentally, of the Angel Credit and the Historic Credit. So those are perfect examples, and they cost taxpayers a lot of money. So the purpose statements are designed to say that when they come, when people look at them, are they meeting their purpose, since so many tax expenditures are not. In fact, people don't even know how those lobbyists got those provisions all those years ago. So the without casting aspersions, the last 2 years of minority that is now was in the majority did not impose purpose statements with their new tax expenditures, which we highlighted in debate that they were violating current law, but they proceeded to create new tax expenditures without purpose statements. But the concept there is, so that's why, yes, you're following the law in your provision.
Very good. Unbeknownst to me, I was following the law. Yeah, thank you, Senator. Anything else on PILP? Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain to me again, I thought I heard you say, and I will, maybe the Senate conferees would benefit by knowing that the PILP account was in the Environment Committee this year. So the Tax Committee did not look at PILP in any way, and so we honestly, I've never heard any of this before. And so I'm sure all the conferees would like to meet with these folks who are testifying, because, I mean, I personally have never met with either one of them. And, again, the Tax Committee did not look at PILT at all, because it is in Representative Wagenius's account. My understanding, and I stand to be corrected, but I think Senator Bach and Representative Thiessen have moved the account to the Tax Committee for purposes of conferring these provisions. Mm-hmm. So I think it's fair to say the House, other than Representative Anzalt, is starting at zero with your provision, and we need some time to learn a lot more about it. But if I can try to understand, you mentioned, Chair Skoy, that You're going from three rates to two, and I don't see that on here. I see current law, two are already the same, and then there's one more. So what am I missing?
Madam Chair, if you look at the Senate rate of 5133 in column two, that's one rate. Mm-hmm. Then the Senate rate of 1.5 and on column four and six. Those are the two rates.
But there's also currently two rates. I thought you said there were currently three, and now it's going to be two, but I see just two current rates. I see 1.283 and 1.283. That's one. And then a 0.642. On this little header here? I'm confused.
Madam Chair, if you look at the bill language, there also was a rate of 1.283 that's not...
Okay, so it's not presented
not
on this spreadsheet.
Presented. Oh, no, there it is, 1.283.
It's on my
spreadsheet.
But that's twice. Where's the third rate?
6.42.
Where's the third current rate is what I'm asking, of a different rate?
Ms. Damon, can you help us with this?
Mr. Chair, members, currently for acquired lands, the county at its option may elect...
I'm sorry. Could she pull her mic up?
Ms. Damon, could you pull your mic a little closer?
Yes.
Thank you.
Currently, for acquired lands, the county at its option may elect to be paid at 0.75% of appraised value, or at $5.13.3 per acre. So that $5.13.3 per acre is a rate that is in the acquired lands category. Most of the counties are paid, elect to be paid at the 0.75% of appraised value rather than at that rate because they receive greater compensation.
So, Mr. Chair, so the third rate is not shown here. It's an option in this one.
And Madam Chair, I probably left the wrong impression there. Yes.
Thank you.
Anything else on PILT? Should we move on?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Myers.
We do have several copies of the task force report that we can present. We are willing to meet with anyone who wants to talk about this, these provisions, but it's going to be just to provide technical input. This was not a department provision or an administrative position that you're talking about, but we are more than happy to help you understand the system. It is very complex, so you can get a better understanding for it. I know Representative Dill did have the House companion to this bill, and I think it was heard in one committee, Representative Davney's in the House. So, but we can provide you all the technical information, and willing to meet with you. Staff does have our contact information, and we are at your disposal whenever you are available to talk about it.
Senator Rest.
I have a question for Senate staff. Did was PILT taken up at all in our environment committee, or only in the tax bill? And is there any accommodation for it in the House Environment Finance?
Senator Rest, I think it was only heard in the tax committee.
What about, and Representative Lynn Chesky indicated that account had been moved to the whatever the equivalent environment finance division is.
Mr. Chair,
and did they do anything?
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. McQuay.
When jurisdictions were decided for the Senate, PILT was in Texas. So it's been in Texas for the entire session. The House differed on that provision, so they've only had PILT in their environment division.
And Senator Rest...
did they do anything?
No.
No.
Okay, that's fine.
Representative Lencheski and I and other conferees in previous years have had this discussion about the payment in lieu. I'm sure it's not completely brand new for this year, but the decision was made previously that this was a property tax issue and should remain in the tax committee. I don't understand why the House moved it into the environment committee. I thought the decision had been made that it was a property tax issue. But
so, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest,
with regard to the resolution of it, if we move forward, it becomes part of the tax committee's target. Is that correct?
Yes, Senator S. This is, would be
not
part of the tax committee's target, not environment.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, is it Damon? Apologize if I'm not saying that correctly. So can you opine, I guess, without, you know, weighing in on a, in a partisan sense, which I know you won't, who are the winners and losers in this proposal compared to current law? You know, who's benefiting from going from a land value assessment versus a flat rate, and who's losing? Can you comment on whether it's geographic or kinds of owners of land or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, do you mean under the current bill, who are the winners and who are the losers?
The proposed Senate provision.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Lencheski,
the counties that would benefit from this change are the most are the counties that have substantial amounts of public land that are not acquired land. These are lands such as school trust lands, tax forfeited lands, other lands administered by the DNR that are not acquired and from private parties.
And Representative Lencheski, I think that the lands that are going that were previously county administered, those lands are winners under this proposal because they move to the same payment as DNR managed lands. Doesn't mean anything to you, huh?
It means nothing to me at all. You know, and Senator Scoy, I just say, you know, I definitely need to get up to speed on this because, you know, we in the metro always wonder why we don't get PILT payments when my community, my suburb, 32% of my land is not on the tax base. We don't get a PILT payment for that. And that's true in most of the suburbs, and we have to service those properties. So I think a lot of us in the metro are concerned about the growth in PILT, and so I certainly can't speak for Representative Anzalk and Representative Norton if she were here, but, you know, it is a program that's paid for by all Minnesotans, and then it's handed out to certain parts of the state, and so I just want to understand it a little better and see if these changes are, I'm sure, you know, you put a lot of thought into it, and you represent areas that have this issue, and I don't, so, I mean, I noticed Hennepin has a droplet here, but you know, we certainly understand that all Minnesotans have to pay for this program, so I would like to learn a little bit more about it. And I was trying to ask our staff, and I think I asked the wrong question in my hurrying, so how did this study come to be? I see it's not here now here, and I'll read it, but how did it come to be? What did you say it was passed, or did Ms. Damon say it was passed in the 2011 legislative session? Okay, and was that in the tax bill, that request for that study, or the environment bill?
Mr. Chairman, members, the language was discussed during special session as we were trying to get government back up and running. It was discussed being in the tax bill, but the department was willing to do the work and to absorb those costs. There was no appropriation for that, so it was in discussion with the tax conference members, but the language is actually passed in the environment bill. So,
interesting. Okay, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to figure out who asked for the study. Generally, to get a study on something like this, there's a provision in the tax bill that makes the study happen, like we just adopted one for fiscal disparities for Taconite. And who carried those bills? How did this even come to fruition? Because I'm interested to know who those authors were and what they were trying to achieve even, you know, before we read the study. And since I think most of us weren't fully in charge of the 2011 tax bill, Senator Senja, maybe you know how this all came to be. But I certainly don't. So I'm just trying to figure out, you know, where did this come from? I don't know if the department knows more about the 2011 tax bill and how it, I don't know.
You know, Madam Chair, we do have some county commissioners here that were on the task force and have been part of it. I wasn't planning on calling them up, but they might be helpful. Representative Anzalk.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I am an old county commissioner, formerly, and I can tell you that equity and issues involving tax capacity
issues involving the overwhelming percentage of public land in the forested top third of the state. This has been a long, long-standing issue. And it looks to me like your language and your proposal is a step forward for the forested region of the state. And I would just note that according to the study that was done, it's the counties in the metropolitan area which have traditionally received the highest payments per acre. So it's kind of a mixed bag here, but I have to say to you, Mr. Chairman, that you're going in the right direction here.
Thank you. Anything else for today on this? I expect we'll get a chance to revisit this.
We'll need to ask the commissioner. He knows where the study came from.
Sure. Yes. Commissioner Franz, do you have any information on the background of this study that we're talking about today?
Mr. Chair, I think like you, I have a perfect memory but a faulty recall system. But as I recall from 2011, and it's pretty amazing that this body is asking me, who's a relative newcomer, about institutional memory here. But I do recall that Senator Ingebrigtsen had authored the bill initially during the session, and that this did come up during the negotiated settlement during July of 2011, and it was sort of at the during that last bit of negotiations that this was brought forward, and it was put in, as Mr. Meyer mentioned, it was put in the environmental bill. But it was something that was had been discussed some by the majority at the time, and it was included at the final negotiations.
And Commissioner, was the reason that it went to the Department of Natural Resources is because the expertise on the PILT program was there, or would the expertise have occurred in DOR?
Mr. Chair, no, that's exactly right. And I think both Ms. Damon and Mr. Meyer should be applauded for the work they did in putting this together, because they do have a lot of the knowledge. These lands are particularly knowledgeable to the DNR, and they manage and are aware of these different lands around the state. And so they have that institutional knowledge. We help supply and support the effort, as well as MMB, in terms of the financial and the revenue effects. But it was DNR because of their expertise in managing these lands.
Okay, thank you. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lichesky, it was in the environment bill, in session laws in a non-codified section, that called upon both the Commissioner of Natural Resources in cooperation with the Commissioner of Revenue, so a joint effort in terms of and MMB to look at this issue and coming up with any recommended changes with regard to purpose, rates, adequacy of current funding, alternative methods, and the formulas. So it wasn't just out. I mean, I don't know who the author of it was, but it wasn't out, you know, outside of a formal request in a bill that was passed and is in session laws.
And I was just informed that Senator Ortman carried this in the first special regular session tax bill. Representative Angell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to belabor the point here, but going back to the study, I've noticed that one of the recommendations was that the distribution formula be modified to allow a minimal payment to townships.
Oh, yes.
How was that resolved?
Well, Representative Van Zelk, what happened is, previous to the, and maybe Ms. Damon can correct me if I'm wrong, but previous to the when they implemented the ability to have your PILT payment calculated on value, when it was just a flat rate for everybody, 10% of the payment went to the townships. When they made the change to value, they did not include the increased dollars in that 10%, so the counties were keeping a larger percentage off of that function than they were the flat rate function. this is an effort to correct that. And Ms. Damon, is that accurate to what happened?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is accurate.
Anything else before we move on? Representative Benson.
Mr. Chairman, maybe, you know, if we do have an opportunity to visit with the testifiers and others about this later. But I'm also serving on the School Trust Lands Commission, so please pardon me. I'm going to ask this question every time I hear the word school trust lands. As far as this, these proposed changes, are there any effects or consequences for school trust lands, either positively or negatively, in relationship to this?
Ms. Meyer, Ms. Damon, Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, members, the current payment rate for school trust lands is 64.2 cents per acre. And under this proposal, that payment rate for those school trust lands to the counties would be increased to $1.50 per acre.
Representative Benson.
And where would those funds come from?
Ms. Damon.
Mr. Chair, members, all of the payments from PILT are from an open appropriation from the general fund.
Okay. Not from the school trust lands account. Okay.
Anything else? Anything else, Senator? Well, thank you for allowing us to delve into the PILT a little bit. So thank you, Ms. Damon, Mr. Meyer. The Ag Homestead. And Madam Chair and members, this is a bill that I carried. I kind of think that is one of the few. There's two farmers left in the Senate. I don't know how many there are in the House. But I felt that this probably was an initiative that needed to go forward and probably was one of the few legislators that would be able to move forward on this. This is a recommendation of the Property Tax Working Group. One of the most complicated areas in the classification currently is this ag homestead, the mechanism for determining whether you qualify for ag homestead. I think the flow chart has been handed out for the current determination, and it is very cumbersome, very complicated, taking a lot of time for assessors. And so when the working group was working this last summer, I guess, this issue came up a number of times, and so I decided that I'd take a run at it with the help from the department to see if we could come up with a mechanism that works. I think this works. I have been in discussion with the ag groups, Farmers Human, Farm Bureau. I had them all in my office, walked through it with them, met with the department staff, and I think we have a pretty good cleanup, and I'd like to have who's going to come from the department? Thank you. Come forward and help us walk through what we're doing here. But one thing that we did do is we are trying to figure out to delay the implementation of this so that we can get the data collected by this December, but not implement it for a year. So if there are some major problems, unintended consequences that we haven't understood, we would have next session to revisit this. But I think that the general criteria for qualifying for homestead should be that you actually have a home on the farm. And that's the major change here, is that in order to qualify, you have to have an owner residing on the land. And currently, they can live two townships or four townships away, and there's all kinds of mechanisms for that not to occur. And I think the purpose of homestead was for people to actually live on the farm when they were qualifying for that. So that was kind of the initiative of this. We've been working on this for most of the session. So I think we've got it in pretty good order, but if we could have the department kind of walk through what was there and what the changes are, I think it would be helpful. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Andrea Fish. I am here with the Property Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. And I'm more than happy to help walk through just what exactly this is doing. As you all know, this infamous flowchart is difficult to follow. I won't make you memorize what is exactly there. When I went through Senator Scoy's bill language, my first attempt at figuring out what it did was just crossing out which rows were no longer applicable. And as you can see in my rather quick attempt at what this would end up looking like, I think eventually we could get this down onto a normal by 11. Is that what we do for paper nowadays? I don't do enough. Really, I think the major change is, as Senator Scoy mentioned, that in order to receive an agricultural homestead, someone must live on that farm, and that someone is either an owner of the property, a qualifying relative of the owner of that property, or in the case of entity-owned lands, those are lands that are owned by LLCs or other family farm corporations, a qualified member of that company has to live on the farm. What doesn't change in the bill is that the property can still be owned by an entity. It can still be owned by a trust or by a natural person. It's just that someone must occupy it in order to establish homestead. Another thing that doesn't change is once homestead is established, once there is a house on that farm that someone lives in, all of the other farmland within four cities and townships can be linked back to that base homestead and still qualify for homestead. What this is simply saying is that if you do have agricultural land is unoccupied, it would not receive homestead. If there is no base homestead within those four cities or townships, these would be agricultural non-homestead. These are often referred to as actively farming homesteads. They do require assessors to gather additional data on income, for example, of the farmers who are farming those properties, sometimes sensitive information that eager to provide to the assessors in order to get that actively farming special ag homestead. And I think that that's maybe the best way of explaining it is the way Senator Scoy had originally said it requires someone to live on the farm.
And thank you, Ms. Fish. And I noticed a little question about the four township when she mentioned that. The reason for that is because while some farms are, their parcels are all contiguous, many times there would be acres that are separated from the home place. You know, there would be a quarter between the home place and the field over there where and we'd want to bring all those acres in. That's would be the purpose of that. Because they aren't all contiguous.
And that would
Representative Benson.
And that would include four townships, if not beyond. So someone owned one on the other side of the state or beyond the four townships, that would not be. That would not qualify. Yeah.
And Representative Benson, that's the current criteria. Only under the current criteria, you just have to live within those four townships. You don't actually have to be residing on one of your ag parcels.
I see.
And this would require that change or a qualified, you know, all these criteria for who does qualify as an owner.
Son or a daughter. Or
yeah.
A relative homestead.
Relative homestead stuff, yeah. And I think that I think the working group, this was their number one recommendation that the legislature go after is to try to clean this up because it's, I mean, it's really something to try to work through this flowchart. Now, there are a couple of unresolved questions, one of which is, well, what kind of percentage of ownership do you have to be considered an owner? You know, is it 5 or 1 or 10? So we're kind of exploring some of that still. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I think we need to delay the implementation of this out so that we have the opportunity to go through another legislative session, collect the information on how many people are really going to be affected by this. How hard is it going to be for them to resolve those impacts? You know, I don't want farms' property taxes to be going up all across the state because of this, but I also want people to, you know, be attached to the place that they're getting ag homestead credit. So I would expect that in some of these situations, if the grandparents live in town, they will probably be transferring some ownership to a grandchild and then continuing to qualify. That would be my expectation.
As long as the person lived on the land.
As long as the grandchild lived on the land. And the original estimate from the commissioner was around 1,000 impacted farms. The updated impact was 6,500, mm-hmm. which made me a little more nervous. Senator Rest.
Which is why we need the information. I'm really attracted to the kind of streamlining of the classification, but we really do need to know how wide the impact is and how many farmers now are taking advantage of the very complicated system in order to claim the homestead when good tax policy says that should not be the case. But it's also, you know, just like some other things, taking a look at modern farming too, and mm-hmm. what is the best way of taxing that land under the property tax system, and perhaps, you know, is the ag homestead mostly a fiction now?
Yeah.
And should we be looking at why do we have these two rates?
Mm-hmm.
We haven't really done that, which is what this work is also, I think, trying to acknowledge, that they're modern farming and ownership is vastly different than it was even 50 years ago, or maybe even 20 years ago.
Yeah. Representative Benson.
Mr. Chair, I know that homesteading is important in the urban area. I own a second property, and I haven't been able to homestead it.
So, well, this is significant tax benefit on the ag homestead. I think it's up to over $1 million at a half the class rate. So it's significant. And, Madam Chair, I feel the need to bring this up at this point in the discussion. I keep a card on my desk from Ms. Zoff. When we finished Green Acres, finally, after multiple years, she sent me a card with a little cow and a bell. It's kind of nice. And it talks about good tax policy might not always be the best politics. So I'm a little hesitant to go full bore into this. I think it's important that we're working on it, but I would like to collect some data and make sure we have a legislative session between now and implementation to make sure there aren't some major unforeseen implications here that we haven't thought of. Anything else? Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for Ms. Fish. If let's say that the grandparents would transfer part ownership to a grandchild, grandson or granddaughter, and let's say it's 10%, what's the department's thought on would that farm qualify for all of the homestead or just 10%, or how does the department view that?
Ms. Fish.
Thank you, Chair. And Senator, under both current law and this provision, if that were the case of, in your example, grandparent transferring 10% ownership to a grandchild who is a qualifying relative, that would actually be a 10% relative agricultural homestead, or pardon me, 10% owner-occupied agricultural homestead, 90% relative agricultural homestead. So, in effect, the property would still receive a full homestead under this provision and under current law.
Senator Sanjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scoia, looking at the last sentence here on the side-by-side, page 18, sections 14 and 15, it just references what I probably think is, maybe I could be wrong, the St. Peter tornado, but in those rare occasions where there may be a fire on a homestead or a tornado which may take out a residence, is there a provision that you have, at least in mind, that would accommodate that kind of rare thing, for the moment at least?
Senator Sanjum, we have been contemplating that. We've discussed that tornadoes don't very often occur in the same location, and that rebuilding in the, you know, if your homestead is destroyed by a tornado, the risk of it coming again is very small, and you could rebuild there. We do have a provision in our bill, and I think the House might have a comparable provision dealing with floods. Yeah. And we put a sunset on that of 5 years. And that is an issue, though, because floods are a reoccurring event on the same area. And it might be that we should revisit that as to whether a farmer that is in the lower lands along a river that floods more frequently than anybody would like, but probably still relatively frequent, might be given some other exemption from this so that they can live on a higher ground, because we are moving people away from the river. And so that is an issue for the flooded areas, I think. Areas that flood. Yeah, I think we both have a comparable provision on that. Did you sunset that, do you know, Ripton or Dabney?
I don't, Mr. Chair, I don't believe we did.
Yeah, we put a 5-year sunset on it, and so we'll have to have a little further discussion about that, I think.
We did not.
You did not? Okay. Anything else?
Senator Scott, I do know that there are some assessors here, but I do believe, to address Senator Sundrum's question as well, that in most cases, if there is a disaster at a home, there is often a reasonable amount of time given in order to rebuild. I can't speak on behalf of the assessors, but I have seen some.
And I think so, but I'll do it again.
So address that.
Thank you, Ms. Fish. Representative Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Senator Coonan can recall, or maybe you can recall, Senator Scott, Chair Scott. Well, I apologize. Maybe Senator Coonan or you, Chair Scoy, can recall the four town issue. Is that what's in this proposal? Four towns?
Oh, four townships.
Four townships. What's the difference between a town and a township?
Ooh. Staff?
Nothing.
Just wondering.
Nothing.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I have been to Four Town. It's up by Senator Scoy's.
Yeah.
It would be a place you'd want to go to.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it's actually in my district. I represent Four Town.
Field trip.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, I think you'd have fun. Say hello to Polly when you're there, would you please?
Maybe you can recall, or Mr. Chair, maybe you can. Didn't this... the four-town issue, wasn't that recently two towns? And how did it get to be four towns? And why, you know, why not 5 or 10 or 1 or 2? Or I thought that was changed to four towns fairly recently as an attempt to give more tax benefits, but maybe I have that wrong.
Well, Madam Chair, I know there was an effort to make it 6 towns, which we did not do, but I don't know when it became 4 towns. Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lencheski, I probably also defer to council, but I know that at least since 1998, it has been 4 cities or townships.
Since 1998.
Okay.
Representative Lencheski.
So I'm just trying to understand, and I hear your caution, and with everything, you know, there's always somebody who's unhappy and somebody who got a bigger tax benefit. And is the purpose to simplify the flow chart or to have less folks get a tax benefit? Or if the net effect is everybody still gets a tax benefit, is it some people even get more or less? Or how do you see this playing out?
Sure. And for me, I think the main purpose is to make the process for applying and receiving this understandable. And it's not perfect yet, but I think it's a lot easier than it was. And I don't feel the need to raise farmers' property taxes. That's not my goal at all. But I would like to make this be uniformly implemented across the state and try to make it more understandable. And if in the process of doing that, it makes the assessors able to spend some more time doing a better job on other areas where they maybe should but haven't been able to because of the complexity of this, that would be a good side benefit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lenchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, you know, I ask, and certainly our caucus and our whole House floor would be divided on whether or not there should be more or less property tax relief for ag homesteads. But I do want to ask, if I may, Mr. Hines, I handed him a note, maybe he hasn't been able to look it up, but if Mr. Hines could tell us the effective tax rates of ag versus other properties, because I think it's helpful for Minnesotans to know. I believe it's the lowest currently in the entire state. So if that's okay, I wanted Mr. Hines to refresh all of our memory, because my concern would be, you know, as we learned in Green Acres, you know, and some of us were trying to fix that, other properties pay more when some pay less. And that would be a concern, you know, that I would have thinking through this provision and then what the state cost is as well.
And Representative Lenchesky, I think on the spreadsheet this is a revenue raise, so farmers will be paying more if this goes through. But Mr. Hines?
Senator, Mr. Chair, of the major classes on the statewide average basis, ag homesteads, you know, are the lowest class effective rate we have at about 0.44%. For relative other properties, ag non-homestead statewide average basis is about 0.8%. Seasonal recreational is about 1%. Homesteads average 1.3%. And then the high ones, commercial industrial, is about just under 4%. So that's the spread, that's the range.
Sure, and you know, I think there's a number of historical reasons for that. You know, the percentage of services required on some of this farmland is pretty small in relation to the property tax that they would pay because of the size of those. And also, I think the state has been reluctant to impose a huge tax burden on the food production. And I think there are some of those historical rationales for this.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lenchesky, I think, too, one of the reasons why we want to go slow on this is I think once the policy is rationalized, that what we're going to see is not fewer people, it's not more people qualifying for the ag homestead, but fewer unless they are willing to change their ownership and actually have someone living on the land, which should be the way in which ag homestead is applied, as opposed to just ag lands that are not homesteaded or that don't have a natural person living on the land and still getting the ag homestead rate, which is why that number. The first estimate, well, this would affect 1,000 people. It's 1,000 people whose taxes would go up, not down. And then the second number, the estimate saying, well, maybe it's as many as 6,500, that we need to get that inventory before moving forward with this policy. And in getting that inventory, that in itself, that information in itself, might suggest even further refinement of the Senate proposal.
Representative Lenchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. I mean, I certainly know how frustrating it is when people try to do reform that benefits everyone, and because one or two people might lose something, everyone decides it's a tax increase. And I certainly understand how that works around here. And I hope that this group of 10 conferees is mature enough to not play that game. So I hear that and I understand that. I will say that I just wanted to put on the record, just because the concern I have in having Mr. Hines read that off, you know, the concept of there's less service needs of those lands, you know, that argument also is made by the business community. And they can bring a lot of arguments forward to show that they're certainly, you know, the highest effective tax rate in the state and relatively have less property service demands often. And so I just, you know, want to be careful as we talk about all the provisions in the bill, kind of, you know, where we're going with all these items. And I really appreciate all the hard work, because I think this bill was sent to Representative Marquardt. but it didn't. I don't know that it was introduced. I don't know, or did we? Did Representative Dabney carry it? I can't remember.
Sure, I thought I sent it to your office.
And I think, well, I'll let maybe when Representative Dabney comes back, he can tell me, because he has. You know, we have our different divisions here. Representative Dabney has a property tax division. Senator Rest does not. So we kind of sorted the bills differently. Yep, so thank you.
Representative Benson.
I probably shouldn't belabor it, but, you know, just if someone has a farm of 160 acres versus 2,000 acres, I would suspect the amount of government services is proportionally different. And secondly, you know, when does a family farm become a corporate farm? Is it when they incorporate, or is it when they get 3,000 acres, or when they move off their 40-acre original homestead?
Well, Representative Benson, and maybe staff can correct me, but I think that the corporate farm law is still in effect in the state, and the C-Stock corporations don't own farms.
Yeah.
But with regard to the amount of land, there is a Tier 1 and a Tier 2, so the homestead applies to the first 1,100,000 of value or whatever it is. And then so if you get to 2,000 acres, you know, at $1,000 an acre, which I think in much of the state is quite low, they would be well up above this tiering.
Okay. Thank you.
Quite low, meaning low.
Land it's values are worth more than $1,000 an acre. Much more. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. Much more. Anything else? Not in my neck of the woods, Madam Chair. Anything else? Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Fish. Let's move to the assessor language that we have. Not that I think we're going to adopt this, but we also have an amendment here. We have some language we've been working on. And I am on Article 2, Section 8. How did I lose that page? I just moved to it. On page 22 of the Senate bill, if anybody's looking at the language. And can we pass the amendment out, please?
Article
A43 amendment.
What page of the bill did you say?
22.
Looking at the bill or the Senate?
I'm looking at the bill. I find the bill more useful. Page 22. And Madam Chair and members, this has kind of been an ongoing effort of mine for a number of years to try to figure out if there was some way that we could bring more uniformity to the assessing that's done across the state, and if there wouldn't be some mechanism that we could do that would bring a little more training to bear to these folks, because this is real important work. And if you recall, you know, back even during the Green Acres debate, I mean, we had 40-some counties that weren't even implementing this statewide program. And I think a number of the property tax issues that we deal with are result of assessing practices that might not be quite as uniform as they could. And so I've thought about making some changes to the requirements for training. I've had a number of meetings with the assessors and talked through the department. And so we've kind of reached some language that we think, while everybody probably isn't going to be supportive of, they think they can live with. And so I'm going to bring the A43 forward, and if you'd be willing to put the language in the bill but not adopt it today, then we'd have this language in the bill for that be fine. Representative Lencheski moves the A43 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. So now we have the language of the A43 amendment in the bill and in front of us. And so what we're trying to do here is to make sure that assessors, as they go to work, get a certain amount of time period to be certified, and I believe that's a 3-year time period. Am I accredited? Am I using the language wrong, Mr. Hagan? Mr. Hagan, would you sit at the table with us, please? And while he's coming up, and then the section, the 9 component, is to try to see if we can give some authority to the Commissioner of Revenue when we find problems in the assessor area that they can actually go out and try to have some authority to fix that. But maybe Mr. Hagan could walk us through what is now the language in the bill. Welcome, Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is John Hagan. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division, and I have not got the language yet. It's coming.
Mr. Hagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This proposal requires that every individual that physically appraises property or inspects it for the purpose of property tax for assessment purposes has to attain the level of accredited assessor by July 1, 2019, or within 4 years of that person becoming certified as an assessor. As Chair Escoy mentioned, the certification provision for assessors, there's a provision that you can work on license for a period up to 3 years, and after that time you have to be a certified assessor, which is the entry level for assessors. And this bill then would provide that after achieving that designation, they'd have 4 additional years to become an accredited assessor. So in effect, the certified assessor provision that's been largely unchanged since 1975 would become more of a apprenticeship position that would, with the expectation that you go from certification to accreditation.
And Mr. Hagan, could you talk to us just a little bit about what the current requirements are for county assessors and who would be working over these as these assessors start out in this profession?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Currently, there's 3 levels of licensure, actually 4. There's certified, which is entry level. There's a certified specialist, which provides that the certified assessors also completed 2 income courses. There's accredited, which this bill provides that everybody would become. And the county assessors have to be senior accredited, which requires 5 years of experience and a narrative appraisal and, I believe, a number of weeks of courses. And they would be, in all instances, all county assessors have to be certified with a narrow provision that they can be accredited and becoming certified within 2 years of their first appointment. So the county assessors, the senior accredited county assessors would be overseeing the work of the assessors who would become accredited under this bill. And another benefit of this, or if you like, not a benefit, but another offshoot of this is there's a lot of problems with counties trying to hire county assessors. There's a shortage of county assessor candidates, particularly outstate Minnesota. And to be a county assessor, you have to be at a minimum accredited at the time of your first appointment. And then again, as I mentioned, you have to become senior accredited within 2 years. If the number of accredited assessors was increased, it would greatly increase that pool. So it would make a lot more potential applicants that could become county assessors, and which would hopefully alleviate some of that burden that the counties are experiencing right now trying to hire individuals, local individuals, or individuals within that regional area to become county assessors.
And Mr. Hagan, did you want to talk about the Commissioner of Revenue assigns fines and dismissal provision?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. keeping in mind, I'm just saying this language. This appears to provide for something of a progressive level of discipline that the Commissioner of Revenue can impose that begins with a censure or reprimand, if you like, could in time progress to a fine, maybe a suspension, or directing the State Board of Assessors to revoke the license of assessor of anybody who is valuing property in the case of malfeasance, misfeasance, or nonfeasance. And it provides some amounts for fines. It provides for an appeal that the commissioner's orders are appealable to the administrative law judge if the parties disagree with the decision of the commissioner.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not going to ask Mr. Hagan to comment on this unless has knowledge, but or the commissioner. My question about this, the A43 that we adopted, is about the independence of the board of assessors. And I think these various boards, I think of the relationship between the Commissioner of Education and the Board of Teaching or the Board of School Administrators, is pretty arm's length. And I'm wondering if this proposal doesn't interfere with that traditional autonomy of the various boards, the control of the profession of their boards, and their relationship between the boards and whatever commissioner may be of interest.
Representative Dabney, I don't think we're making any changes there other than we're changing the time periods that people have to reach certain levels. But maybe Mr. Hagan would be helpful. Mr. Hagan?
Sure, Representative Dabney. You are correct. The State Board of Assessors has no relationship with the Commission of Revenue. They are totally independent of the commissioner. And if you like the wording in this provides that the commissioner can instruct the State Board of Assessors. I believe I saw that. The commissioner
direct on page 1.12.
Yeah. So they would be, instead of just requesting, they'd be in this language it directs the State Board of Assessors to discharge an assessor. Sure. So I'm not sure if that speaks to your question or your concern.
No, very good, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And does the Board of Assessors currently have the ability to revoke the license of any assessor and fine and all the other stuff in here?
Mr. Hagan.
Senator Dietzick, they do. They do have the authority to, I believe, to suspend licenses. And I'm not certain they have the authority to fine, but they do have the authority to suspend licenses.
Commissioner Franz, do you have anything you'd like to add to this?
Chair Scoy, no, I just want to say that I think one of the concerns that you mentioned initially, and it certainly is at the bottom of your efforts here, is to ensure that we have some uniformity around the state, that the quality of assessments is uniform, and that I think we all know that one of the most frustrating elements of being a property taxpayer is variation or differences in the approach taken on the valuation. And it's a hard job, and I think you recognize that, as we all do, that assessing is a very, very difficult job. And on the other hand, it's really important that we provide some sort of certainty and uniformity, because without that, people do get frustrated, taxpayers get frustrated. And so I certainly, from a point of view of the educational, the certification requirement, certainly are supportive of trying to make sure that we have assessors around the state that are uniformly qualified and capable of providing assessments. But in terms of the issues that Representative Dabney raised, I think one of the issues is for us is with such a wide-ranging area and so many assessors out there, I think one of the concerns that you've addressed here is trying to provide the commission with a more direct authority to intervene. And so I think that is an issue that you have to consider as conferees, and certainly we would take that, or I would take that, or any commissioner would take that with a great amount of concern and try to work through the State Board of Assessors. But I think it really depends upon how active you think the Commissioner of Revenue needs to be in ensuring that there is uniformity and that all appraisers perform professionally. So it's a tough issue, I think, in that regard.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, I share your concerns. I was struck coming into the property tax division, and I'd ask, have someone in my office and say, so how do the assessors do this? And there'd be a long pause. Well, it kind of depends on where you are. I don't want to go into the ethanol plant issue. case in point.
Some language on that.
Yeah, we all do. We all do. And thank you to the commissioner for that language. This certainly is not a reflection on the current commissioner. But I do hope before we actually adopt this, we'll perhaps revisit your initial language that it looks like the A43 is deleting, and then go to this question of are we breaching the independence of a board? And while we can all share the frustration and share the goal of a more uniform assessing process across the state on all properties, for all the right reasons, I remain concerned about that breach that I see in the A43 that we've adopted into the bill, not adopted in the final report, I understand.
Representative Dabney, I think that's a very good thought, and I've been writing some notes on my page here that I think we should contemplate if this is to move forward an additional mm-hmm. amendment. Representative Enzo.
Thank you. I don't know hardly anything at all about the level of competency or the level of training, the technical assistance that's provided on a statewide basis for assessors. But I can tell you that there will be counties, small counties, a long way from this building with low population densities where this language could have a very chilling effect on people interested in being assessors. I understand the goal. I understand the need for uniformity. I think it may be an unattainable goal, however, at the end of the day. But
Well, Representative Van Zelk, I don't think we made any changes to the criteria for the county assessor in this proposal. So the county assessor would be the same. And in Clearwater County, which is a relatively small county, I think they have one assistant.
Okay.
And there would be the change would be not that they don't have to strive to the same level of training. It would be that they have to do it sooner. Is that accurate, Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chair, yes. In fact, the senior accredited level that county assessors have to be was not even embraced or required until I believe it was 1987. Prior to that time, in the 1973, I believe, they created a certified and accredited assessor designation. And as time went by, the accredited assessor designation grew in requirements. And then at some point in time, the legislature required that county assessors, the complexity of their job required even a higher level of professionalism, so they created a senior accredited level and required that all county assessors and all regional representatives for the Department of Revenue had to be senior accredited. But you are leaving that unchanged. The only additional education requirements are for the base level, entry level certified assessor.
And Mr. Hagan, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but I know you were the assessor up in Lake of the Woods County prior to being down here. How many people were in that shop, and what do you think the impact would be on Lake of the Woods County?
Mr. Chair, there were three people, including myself, when I was county assessor in Lake of the Woods. They currently have an assessor in that same county who is senior accredited, and they have a second assessor who's sort of working towards accreditation, I believe. So it would be quite insignificant for Lake of the Woods. I do recognize there are some counties with less education. But.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan.
Thank you.
Anything else, members? Thank you, Mr. Hagan. We'll set this aside for now, and maybe sometime we'll revisit this. I'd like, if you guys have questions, the assessors are around. I'm sure they'd like to visit with you. They have concerns about this, too. So one of the things that I don't want to do is I'm a little bit concerned about the mechanism for attaining these levels of training. Do we have the personnel available to do the accreditation? And I think it's a relatively small pool of people that do that. So as my discussion with the assessors, I've kind of been willing to look at a little longer time frame, not because I want to spread it out, but because I think there are some issues with getting all this number of people through the process in a short period of time. Anything else, Commissioner?
No,
thank you. Okay. SFIA. I like your language better. I think we should move on. What do you want to do, Madam Chair? Do you want to talk about SFIA?
You want
to. No?
You want to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Let's move on. Other than to say, the only thing I'm going to say about SFIA is, from my perspective, this is not a rural issue. Because the majority of the people that are going to be accessing these large tracts of lands for recreation live down here, I believe. They're hunters and bird watchers. The concern about the fragmentation of the forest is a broader issue than just forestry. It should be a concern of everybody in the state to not have the forest fragmented up. From an economic perspective, I think that the areas that have these large tracts of private land would be better off economically if they were developed and parceled up and people started living and recreating on those parcels as opposed to them all remaining empty and full of forest land. So unless I start hearing from some of my colleagues from a broader base than just northern Minnesota, I'm really not all that concerned about SFIA. I just am not. And so we'll see where this goes, it's not one of my priorities. Oh, yeah. So just I'm sure people are understanding. I'd like to hear from other legislators what their perspective is on this. Senator Lori's Cloquet Fire District.
That is a priority.
That is a priority. Article 2, Section 39. And I think that what Senator Lori has going on here, if I remember, and maybe Senator Rest, you can help me with this, or staff, they currently have a ambulance fire district. They have differing areas of coverage, and they need this change to allow those two, the ambulance and the fire district, to operate effectively. And I wonder if Mr. Silva...
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, currently the Cloquet and Perch Lake Township, they established the Cloquet Area Fire and Ambulance Taxing District. It's my understanding that there are some areas of this district that receive both fire and ambulance services, and then there are some that only receive the ambulance or the fire. So Section 39 of the Senate's bill is allowing, just clarifying that the district can provide fire or ambulance services or both, and it's also allowing that current members or members to join the district that are not contiguous to current members. Currently now only new municipalities that are contiguous to a member district as it exists now are able to join, and that would remove that requirement. In Section 40, it's giving the board the authority to effectively separate the levy amounts for, if you look on page 47, line 27, for municipalities that receive ambulance services only, the levy amount would be not to exceed 0.019% of taxable market value. But for those areas that receive both fire and ambulance, there's a separate levy amount on line 29, and that would be a rate not to exceed 0.2835% of taxable market value. That is the current rate as it is now. The proposal would separate those between the fire and the ambulance and just the ambulance services.
Madam Chair, would you think this would be something that you might be willing to move on today, or should we not go beyond explanation?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
Hey, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to honestly remember if this was Representative Sundin's
bill. That's correct.
I know, Representative Dabney had to step away.
Yeah, well,
he doesn't have it.
I can help.
Sure.
Sure. Madam Chair, this was a late bill, and there was some uncertainty in the community as to this. We got this late, I believe. Senator Rest.
I think the dilemma for this fire and ambulance special taxing district is really illustrated by looking at the map of service. I think that was really a huge clarification for us, and we have it here.
and Senator Skoyte might want to look at that too and then pass it on, about what the restrictions were and then where they want to be able to serve. And, of course, the length of the area that is served can only be so far because of the time that's involved in getting the emergency vehicles to actually the spot where the fire or the ambulance needs to go. So there is a limitation on that, but some of the folks now are not included in that district, and this is a way of making sure that the service is provided to that whole district as they want and that the affected taxpayers are paying for it. But appreciate your looking that over.
Madam Chair, should we just move on?
We're just having a memory issue here. Because I thought that after, and we just don't know, and we'll have to come back because I thought that after Representative Dabney's committee finished up, I heard it. Oh, we didn't hear it.
No, you didn't hear it.
So sorry.
okay.
Yeah, can we just talk to Representative Sundin and maybe Senator Coonan
Mr. Chair.
Isn't that kind of in your area too?
If I could just add for a second, Buck McAlpin at the State Ambulance Association.
Mr. McAlpin.
This was a late bill. You're right. We worked with Senator Skoyte and Senator Rest over in the Senate with it, and we have been working with Representative Sundin. There was a concern about one township about the .20, the high side levy of the fire and the ambulance. It gets current coverage, and the ambulance primary service areas are unique in Minnesota that they're franchised and they are a larger area to cover like the map Senator Rest just had. So what we worked on with Representative Sundin, and he talked to the townships, was an agreement that we would set the cap at the .019. So it wouldn't be they wouldn't be receiving both fire and ambulance, only ambulance, and it adds five more townships to their large taxing district.
And we will check with Representative, who's the House author again?
Sundin
and Senator Laurie, and we'll bring this forward again. Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, I hear that the ambulance and fire want this to the cities, to the mayors and councils.
Our recollection is that they have worked out an agreement. They're all supportive of it.
Just check.
Sure. Yeah. No. Conservation easements. One of my favorite topics.
Yeah, here comes another one.
God, geez, I'm just on a roll
bomb
today.
Throwers.
Yeah.
It's all right.
So, we are going to move to Article 2, Section 13, conservation easements.
Of the Senate bill.
Of the Senate bill. And part of the issue, Madam Chair, and this, while I think this has been highlighted by recent activities with some legacy purchased conservation easements, relatively large parcels, high dollar value, where they bought a large easement. The company then went to court to try to get its valuation written down. Now they're proposing to also re-enroll in SFIA. That's what started this discussion. But what happened is I started to think about this and get my arms around what is going on. There is a lot of little, small conservation easements. Now, the purpose of those easements can be whatever the person that puts them on, what they want. Maybe they're establishing a hunting preserve. Maybe they're just don't want development on their land for the future ever. But whatever the reason, these conservation easements go on the land, and then the value gets reduced. And so the owner accomplishes his goal of land use. Many instances they receive payment, could be a large payment, and then they shift the cost onto the surrounding landowners by getting reductions in their property taxes. And I just think we ought to have a discussion about whether that's the mechanism that we want. And I understand that many people view this as a mechanism for tying up land at a reduced cost, because it's probably cheaper to put these permanent easements on than it actually is to buy the land. But at the same time, why should that cost get shifted onto the neighbors? And in many areas, these are people who have parcels of land that they want to set up as pheasant hunting or duck hunting or who knows what kind of areas, and they put an easement on it, and then after the easement goes on, they argue, well, the usage is reduced because of the easement, and therefore the highest and best use should be reduced and the value should go down. And I don't think that I think that that's really fair for everybody else who lives in those areas. And so we've had a little discussion in committee and kind of come around to an ongoing thought about that. And Senator Dietzick, you want to add something to the discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. And part of the question that I had, and it gets to the situation you were talking about, is what is the highest and best use? Because in certain cases, they still may have mineral rights, they might have timber rights, they might have air rights, they just don't have development rights. But what is the highest and best use? And
Senator Dietzick, I think in most cases when these conservation easements go on, mining and that type of activity would not be allowed any longer, because I actually have a parcel of land that has a restriction on it, and they're recorded on your land title, on your abstract, and they are into perpetuity that the land is to be dedicated for whatever the purpose is. In our case, it's for wildlife. But I never went and asked the assessors to reduce the value on those parcels, because that would have just shifted the property tax on to my neighbors, and I put the easement on as a landowner, and I should bear the cost of that. Representative Lonchesky.
Mr. Chair, just a thought on that. So I'm just trying to think of, like, if I have a cabin, and my cabin's in Wisconsin, so it doesn't apply here, but so let's say I have a cabin in Minnesota, and I do make an agreement to have a conservation easement, therefore limiting some use to me forever, and I might get a compensation for that. And so I think I understand the argument in the present tense, but if you go forward, let's say 10 years from that activity, and my next-door neighbor at the cabin, who has a big, you know, the next cabin over that has, you know, lots of acreage, and they didn't do a conservation easement, so they're relatively have a higher, they pay higher property taxes than I do, because I've argued that my land value has gone down because I have this use on my property that's in a conservation easement. My neighbor, who's been paying higher taxes all along than me, they could sell their land and subdivide and do things, build more buildings than I can. So I have foregone something that I can never in the future go forward then and say, you know, now I want to do that, because I've permanently given something up. And I might have gotten compensation at the time, but there is less value to me now as a result of that activity. So, I mean, thinking about it currently and into the future, I have different feelings about it.
And the landowner who puts the easement on probably gets compensated by not having development, because that's what they don't want. They don't want more neighbors. And I would draw your attention to the language that does not apply to riparian along waterways, lakes, rivers, particularly concerned about buffer strips that deal with water quality and water quantity issues. So this language would not apply to those parcels that are around lakes or rivers or streams or sloughs and that kind of stuff.
And maybe Representative Benson or Mr. Chair or Representative Anzalk has thoughts on this, but you know, another thing I think about is, so the price tag for the conservation easements, whether they're purchased through Legacy or somebody else. But if they're government funded, you know, then all the taxpayers, again, are paying for those. You know, I would imagine that where these are happening, if you represent those communities, you don't want to see this the property tax increase as a result of that. I think that's what you're saying. On the flip side, I mean, those of us who don't have these lands, you know, we're paying for those often through government. We're paying for those conservation easements or for access or for whatever we're trying to do. And
as a person,
you know, it's unclear to me then if I live in New Hope and I'm helping pay for this activity through general taxation, how that plays out going forward then as the community where it's happening, and maybe they're having an issue as it relates to this property versus that property. But for the bulk of us who are paying for it but not in the game of property to property in the political subdivision, you know, I'm trying to see it from that perspective as well. And, you know, I'm just trying to process it all. It's all so.
Yeah, no. Representative Enzo.
Well, thank you. for starters, I would say that to arrive at an equitable and fair solution to this, that's going to require some really hard work, because it's unclear to me what our highest value is, what we value in particular in northern Minnesota the most. Do we value the conservation easement philosophy and approach that we are taking and have taken, and it looks like we're going to take some more? Is that a higher value than the corresponding impact on other people's property taxes? There's got to be a meeting in the middle somewhere here. I quite frankly don't know what that is. I'm open to proposals. I don't think, with all due respect, Senator Scoy, that your language gets me at that place. And I think it might be appropriate, with whatever time we have remaining here today, for you to entertain some participation by some of the stakeholders, because this is a big issue.
Well, I don't know that we will do public testimony today, but certainly would encourage you to visit with all the stakeholders before anything would potentially go forward. I'm fully aware that this is not without some controversy, but, you know, this is an issue that I think the state needs to kind of wrestle with, because with more and more of these easements being proposed, and now with the legacy funding that provides a revenue stream to accomplish those, I think we have to figure out what's going to happen to the folks that live around those. And from my concern, and somewhat with this FIA thing, I think it's a restriction on the economic activity of those areas that have those parcels of land. And so you place these restrictions on, the current landowner gets compensated. The next landowner who buys it should go in with his eyes wide open, because that easement's already on there. And so I don't have any real sympathy for the second landowner. But the original landowner got compensated for that. And whether it's monetary or usage-wise, that's their compensation and their decision. But why should those costs shift on to their neighbors when they receive the money or the compensation? I just can't figure that out in my rationale. I mean, we generally don't like to do that type of shifting, you know, around of the property tax.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Representative Manzo.
At the time of this huge, huge conservation easement mm-hmm. discussion that we had in the legislature and the subsequent creation of the conservation easement by the legislature, it was this notion of addressing the patchwork quilt of land ownership in northern Minnesota, which dominated mm-hmm. and drove the decision. The property tax issue and effect on adjacent landowners and local units of government, that part of the discussion never occurred.
And Representative Van Zylk, part of that is because they're in court arguing over the valuation. I don't think that the folks representing the expenditure of legacy money on that anticipated that.
Well, Mr. Chair, the timing of filing in tax court and that part of this dilemma is a little hazy to me. I'm not sure about dates, and I'm not sure about who did what when, and perhaps a little clarity with regard to that would be helpful.
Well, I was asking the commissioner, and I saw a shrug of shoulders, so we might have to get that information to us as to where we're at in that process.
That's okay. Cool.
Okay. Representative Lemcheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as we're, you know, obviously you all have your heads around it and you support this bill, and just as we're thinking about it, I'm just trying to, I can hear the issue between the landowners and the local unit of government, but I'm trying to step aside to the 5 million Minnesotans who, you know, we do have, you know, who are putting in money through legacy. You know, we're paying higher sales taxes on our toothpaste every time we buy it for legacy. And people are going out and buying up this land or conservation easements. And, you know, so for the people who are not involved in the exchange between properties where it's going on or, you know, losing value of their land, you know, they're just standing outside it helping contribute to the activity. You know, they're also helping contribute activity to things like getting a property tax refund that's larger now if your value is higher when your property taxes go up, or more LGA in the formula if the net tax capacity of a community goes down as a result of these activities. So just trying to juggle all those pieces, not just for the internal part of the community's experiencing, but for the whole state. And, you know, I don't really have any answers on that, but it just seems it needs to be massaged a little to think through if and overall everybody's losing on this or gaining on this, or, you know, just trying to think about it locally.
Yeah, and here's one of the things that I think about when I think about this, and I think you're absolutely right that you need to contemplate that. So if the legacy through the state through the legacy funding mechanism is paying sales tax and buying easements, so if we let the value of the property go down, the cost to the legacy fund is less, potentially. If we don't let the cost of the property taxes go down, then the easement cost is higher. I think that's the argument that we're having here. So if the cost of the easement goes up and you don't let the property taxes go down, then the local community where that land don't pay for it. But if the cost of the easement goes down, so you spend less legacy money because the property taxes are going to go down also, so the overall cost is being absorbed by the locals. And that's the part that I have so much concern with. Because that's exactly what I think we're talking about. Because the cost of the legacy fund, if you don't let the property taxes go down, might potentially be higher. They might not. We don't know that. But I think that's the concern. And I understand that you are all going to need some time to get our head around
yes.
this.
Can I ask one more thing?
Sure. Representative Lemcheski.
Just, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just one more thing to throw out there. And I Don't know what I'm talking about, but I just want to put it out there.
Sure.
No, I don't. This is where the Environment Committee is. You know, they're all embroiled in this, too. And maybe Rep. Anzel, you can help me, or Senator Skoy. Again, you know, from the overwhelming majority of Minnesotans are not involved in this internal issue. They are payers for the activity, and they're silent on what's happening in the community. And that's the bulk of the conferees around the table here. So from the rest of our perspective, you know, I often wonder if the taxpayers who are paying for Legacy to buy these conservation easements, what's the deal they're getting here? And maybe they shouldn't be buying conservation easements. Maybe they should be buying the land.
Hey. I'd go there. I'd go there.
Well, just Rep. Anzel maybe
100% my point. That's 100% my point.
Well,
buy the land and get control. Well, the reason they do conservation easements is because it's cheaper. And the reason, part of the reason it's cheaper is they shift the cost onto the local units. And to be honest, there aren't all that many of these things in my neck of the woods because we're already pretty regulated. But if you go out the Mississippi or the Minnesota River, there's efforts to put a lot on that rock area. And, you know, I just think there's a other area. It's a pretty broad impact across the state, I think, if you really sit down and look at where they are. But that's exactly my point.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, I mean, part of it, though, is it cheaper this way? I mean,
sure it is.
Maybe it's – I just don't know enough to know.
Sure. I'm seeing a fair amount of head nodding in the back row. Well,
you know, between Pilt and SFIA and Ag Homesteads and the Coal Cave Fire and the conservation easement.
How am I doing today, Madam Chair?
That's a lot of Greater Minnesota talk.
Representative Benson first.
Mr. Chairman, I hesitate to say I was on the Wagenius committee and the Dell committee. And these things are quite complicated, and I will plead innocent on the ground as it's my first assignment to those committees. But is this buying of easements less expensive in the short term and more expensive in the long term?
Well, I think
we're all short term around here.
Representative Benson, if it's a perpetual easement, probably cheaper in the long and short term. Now, if it's a temporary easement that they're going to have to come back and revisit in 20 or 50 years, well, that might be another matter because your environment protection goes away at some point, and then they're going to have to come back and reassess the value and potentially pay considerably more. And so I think that it depends on if it's permanent or perpetual or temporary.
So, Mr. Chairman, which is it generally?
Well, it depends on I was the author of the CREP bill way, way back when, and I was in the House. And that was the argument. Are we going to have 50-year easements or permanent easements? And my view is my crystal ball is kind of cloudy, and permanent is so long that I can't see there from here. But other folks think permanent is the way to go. Representative Anzel.
Oh, well, thank you. I can't resist an additional comment here. What we're really dancing around is a huge conservation easement of about 190,000 acres in northern Minnesota. And you've heard us say over and over and over and over again in greater Minnesota, in rural Minnesota, in rural northern Minnesota in particular, we have property wealth problems. We have low tax capacity. Property taxes don't work for us. That's the overview. The conservation easement at the time made access a real permanent thing. Motorized traffic, recreational vehicles, hunting, fishing, berry picking, bird watching, It was a good idea. And it still is a good idea. It's just that nobody contemplated the property tax impact. And I can tell you, I've looked at some numbers from some townships, and I've looked at some numbers from one of the counties involved in this, and you pay attention when you look at the numbers, the potential property tax problems. So we need to get people's arms around this, and perhaps we should save this for another day. And again, the stakeholders need to come together, and we need to really work at finding a responsible and equitable solution.
Just briefly, I think that might be the poster child, but it's not the only concern I have. I have concern about these 100-acre, 200-acre things that are going on across the state. Senator Rest has information.
I think as an absolute illustration of the remarks that you just made, this is from the LCCMR, their 2014 recommendations going forward. And you can see where that dark purple in northern Minnesota,
yeah,
it just really, really does illustrate the property tax almost zero base in northern Minnesota, and why these easements are a really significant issue in resources for local governments up there, as opposed to more of a scattering throughout the rest of the state. But that's what we need to keep in mind as we're dealing with a policy issue. And again, as Senator Scoy said, rather than just a single elephant in the room, but it is it's a more widespread general policy toward the impacts of these confirmation easements on the local government's ability to provide the needed services.
And Madam Chair, if members have the language in front of them, and I don't care if we do this now or later, but there is a language change that would have to occur before this was adopted. I think perhaps it would be wise to adopt it now so that the interested parties would know that I wasn't intending for this. On line page 25, line 11, there's language dealing with an exemption for parcels of land in excess of 1,920 acres that allow public motorized access. I think that that's language that we should not be including, and I should remove that at this point so that the interested parties know that I don't intend on. Are you okay with that? Representative Lencheski removes on page 25, line 11, delete the semicolon, the language or number two, parcels of land in excess of 1,920 acres that allow public motorized access. Any questions, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Thank you, Representative Lencheski. Well, thank you for that discussion. I think that's good. I think we'll all kind of try to wrap our heads around this as an issue and see if there's something that we can agree upon, that we can move forward with. And if nothing else, I've been around here long enough to know that sometimes these things take a little longer than one session, so it can be part of an ongoing discussion. I'd like to move it this year if I can, but I'm a realist, so let's see where we go. State obligation of special assessments, Article 2, Section 33. The next
Article
one under conservation
13.
Yeah, that was conservation.
Article section 33. Misspoke.
Section 33.
Page 19 on the side by side.
Side by side.
This won't take very long. Madam Chair and members, in the ongoing discussion of the special assessments, street improvement assessments, and fire districts and all of that, it has come to our attention that the state is not uniformly paying these special assessments across the state. There's a number of state buildings that the state has decided not to pay. It's not being consistent. I think that we're not going to let me turn around. Do we have an amendment on this? No? Okay. Anyway, I don't think we're going to do much more here this year. I have been in discussion with MMB and other agency folks, and we're going to collect some information through the summer. I'm going to ask the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties to survey their members to find out if there are parcels that are of concern. I know in Bemidji, the DNR has a parking lot that they decided not to pay the stormwater assessment on. I mean, we can't figure out why, but they did. It doesn't seem to be reasonable that they wouldn't pay it in Bemidji, but they do somewhere else in the state. So we're just going to collect some information. Want to make the conference committee aware of this as an issue. It's going to be ongoing, but sometime in the future we'll get more information. I just don't have enough information to move forward today. These are all local assessments. They're not reported to the state. They're really hard to figure out what's out there and what's not. I do have an issue with regard to Moose Lake that I'm going to ask the conference committee to contemplate. There are two state institutions in the city of Moose Lake. The city thought they had worked out an agreement with those facilities. They let the bids and started their sewer line stormwater project out that way. In the intervening time, the agencies kind of said, oops, we decided not to be part of your project. I think in the years since, there has been some compromise reached, but I'm going to, in the Senate bill, I do have some dollars to help the city of Moose Lake, and I'm going to try to move forward on that this session. But with regard to the other language, I'm not. Representative Anzell.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thanks. Does this section, does this language have anything to do with the Department of Revenue's facility in Ely?
Oh, Representative Van Zelk, I don't believe so.
Okay.
But
so.
That's I don't
good.
Think so. No.
That's
no.
good. Very good.
No, it's just.
Good answer.
To be honest, Representative Van Zelk, in numerous discussions that I've had with the city of Bemidji, and it started with their request for a fire district because they want to build a fire station outside of the city limits. And then we started talking about their assessing of the fire district and what they were going to do with the college and the other government buildings. And they said, oh, well, by the way, the government buildings aren't paying our current assessment. And I said, what? And so they sent me the letter, and that's where we're at now. And so we're going to get more information to see how many of these buildings there are out there and what the scope of the problem is, because we just don't know today.
Thanks.
Anything else? Anything? Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to talk about that just a little bit. Senator Resch? No, we're not going to talk about the armor grants. We're going to move to the multi-state compact. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I do think this is a section of the bill that we would like to move on and take a vote on, and it does involve the state's relationship with the multi-state tax commission. And so to that end, I would move that we adopt Article 4, Section 5 of the Senate bill, and then the provisions in Section 50, which is a repealer, 290-171, 290-173, and 290-174.
Did staff get the Senator Rest motion?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you. Department, Ms. Von Mosch?
Mr. Chair, members, the effect of these provisions is to withdraw Minnesota from the multi-state compact that was enacted in the provisions that Senator Rest cited as part of her motion. In addition, Section number 5 amends Minnesota Statute Section 270.03 to permit the commissioner to continue to participate in joint state audits conducted by the Multi-State Tax Commission. The Department of Revenue proposes the repeal of the Multi-State Tax Compact. The compact provides that states may withdraw from the compact by enacting a law repealing it. Minnesota enacted the Multi-State Compact in 1983 and then repealed Articles 3 and 4 of the compact in 1987. Article 3 contains the provisions allowing taxpayers to elect to apportion income under the compact or other state law. And Article 4 contains the Uniform Law, Minnesota Statute, Section 290.175, which permits taxpayers to elect apportionment under either a particular Minnesota apportionment provisions or under the Uniform Law. As a result of Minnesota's repeal of Articles 3 and 4, multi-state taxpayers no longer had the option to use the equally weighted three-factor formula of property, payroll, and sales to apportion income to Minnesota instead of the Minnesota formula that weighted sales at 70% and property and payroll at 15% each. And then since 2007, Minnesota has been in the process of phasing into 100% sales apportionment. So for tax years beginning in calendar year 14, we will have achieved the full phase-in at 100% sales. The department believes that the legislature's repeal of Articles 4, 3 and 4 of the compact 26 years ago eliminated the option for use of the uniform law to apportion income. However, the department believes that it's prudent for the legislature to repeal Minnesota Statutes 290.171 in its entirety.
Thank you, Ms. Von Mosch. Questions, members? Madam Chair? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Thank you, members. Pension aid. Well, Madam Chair, I think that might be a little daunting for today. I know we both have provisions there, but they're different funding mechanisms. As a separate bill? Oh, okay. Okay. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on that, something to think about. I'm glad the Senate is committed to getting that done, and the House is too. And I think when targets actually get handed out, it may occur to the Senate that the House's position would not eat into a target for the tax bill. So that's just something to think about, because if we do it in the way the Senate has it, we'll have to count, I think it's, is it 30 million?
30 million, yeah.
Yeah, and the way the House has brought it forward, it's not part of the target.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Just a thought.
Chairman,
when things get tight.
Representative Lincheski doesn't necessarily have to be part of the tax target. It can be a target some other place.
and I think that LGA is more than we want to undertake now. So what do you think about next week, Madam Chair?
Yeah, we're not meeting tomorrow, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's your call.
No. I think we should try to do our best. We understand we're all going in the morning, and you have a tax committee in the morning, so we'll wait till after that.
My tax committee has been delayed to Wednesday now.
Oh. Okay, well, we were thinking of posting in the afternoon, but maybe we should reconsider that.
We're going into session at 12:30,
Mr.
Chairman. Lincheski.
Would you want to meet for a little bit in the morning first, and then we could recess and then see how the days work out for everybody? Would that work? Whatever you want.
No, your call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the data practices.
Conference Committee, I think it's literally 8 to 10. It could be quick, so you guys can meet, and then just get a list of what you're meeting on would be helpful.
I think we should try to squeeze in some hours Monday morning. Representative Anzel.
I'm sorry to hear that. I would prefer sometime in the afternoon or evening rather than morning on Monday.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I won't be here Monday night.
Is anybody going to be here Monday?
It doesn't matter if I'm here or not. Senator Russ can representative of the
maybe
Senate.
What we should do is think about, since we are on Monday, I think we have 2 weeks left for everything to be done. So I do think, in my opinion, Mr. Chair, maybe what we can do is kind of with our staffs figure out who's going to be present between kind of 8 and 10 and see what, because we won't want to take up anything that, you know, say Representative Anzel can't be there, and we don't want to take up anything that would affect him. If you have to be gone in the evening, we won't want to take up.
Sure.
So maybe we can work out pieces to work through that
I think people care about.
There
are still some things that we can do and maybe even take some action on, even if one of us is gone. I certainly know what Senator Scoy's position is on everything in the bill, and so we're prepared to take some actions when I'm not here, when he's not here. So
we can do this as a four member conference.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
Representative Lanchesky.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think we feel the same way. I'll just want to talk to my members a little bit about the parts they care about. I mean, there's some real obvious ones that we need certain conferees present to figure out, and then ones that are kind of, and let's admit it, there's still a lot of dry stuff in there.
And, you know, we've got the sales tax that I know you want to hear about. Right. Senator Rest is preparing for that. Senator Rest.
Chairman, you know, it might be helpful, since there were a number of the items today that we discussed, that we could, you know what the Senate position is on those, if we, you know, could, you know, go back, for example, to the Cloquet Fire District provision. If you all would look that over, there might be some things that we could take some action on that are not part of a global kind of thing, but that affect members and things that they have brought forward individually. That, you know, for example, to consult with Representative Sundin and make sure we have the affected local governments with regard to that fire district proposal. You know, we could act on that, I think, regardless of who's here.
Sure. And we could,
as long as we have three on each side.
And we could revisit the same similar. I think there's a couple there that we might want to revisit, too. So there would be work to do. Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We already posted for Monday, so everybody should ignore that post. we'll take a little conversation offline and try to get that figured out. So looks like, if I understand correctly, what the Senate conferees would want and we all are okay with is we would do some work in the morning, recess, and do it again, and we'll just manage the issues for who's present.
Yep, sounds great.
Yep.
Thank you.
Anything else? Committee's adjourned.